Call the next case.
George Mason University v. Willie. David G. Drummond, Senior Assistant Attorney General, Appellant Counsel, Jason F. Delman, Harley Ann Jalen, Appellee Counsel.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, this case is arising from a student domicile reclassification request from Ms. Malik. The reviewing and operative statute for the lower court was 23.1-510C, in which the circuit court's only function is to determine whether the decision reached by the institution could reasonably be said on the basis of the record, not to be arbitrary, capricious, or otherwise contrary to law. Now, the reviewing court is not to take in new evidence. It's not to reweigh the evidence. It's not even there to find out if the university made the right decision. It's only there to search the record to see if there's some reasonable basis for the university's decision. The university's decision, in any institution's decision, would be whether or not a student has presented or established through clear and convincing evidence Virginia domiciliary intent for the requisite period of 1 year. In this particular case,
the proof there, clear and convincing, amplifies arbitrary and capricious. So now the test is, could you have not found clear and convincing without being arbitrary and capricious? Which is a more stronger doctrine than a preponderance.
Correct, Your Honor. So that's what is sometimes confusing to the statute for the reviewing court. They're not looking to see if the university made the right decision when it found that the student did not establish through clear and convincing evidence the student's domicile in Virginia. They're looking to see if that decision, the institution's decision, that the student didn't carry that clear and convincing burden, has some reasonable basis within the record. So it's a very, very high standard for a student to overcome if they have lost at the institution level and is appealing to the local circuit court. In this particular case, we had an admission from the student from the outset that Ms. Malik had came to the Commonwealth to pursue her educational objectives. What's interesting about that is that several years prior, in the George Mason University v. Floyd case, the exact same issue came up and was found to be, I believe, dispositive for this court and overturning the lower court's decision. This decision was raised at the lower court, and there's not been any attempt to really differentiate or distinguish it in its application to this case. And that's one of the main reasons why we felt like we had to appeal this case. Before Ms. Malik came to George Mason University, she went to Northern Virginia Community College. She moved to Virginia in 2013. Several months later, she enrolled in Northern Virginia Community College, and she continued her studies there until she got into the university she applied in the fall of 2016 and registered for classes in January of 2017. Her educational objectives in the record stayed consistent. She went to school when she first came here. She went to school. She came to Virginia for educational purposes. Nothing in the record shows that she has changed that position. Now, she has transferred to a new institution, but we believe that Ms. Malik's admission at least gives the university a reasonable basis to find or decide that she did not carry her burden of establishing a domicile in Virginia by a clear and convincing evidentiary standard. Now, the statute, 23.1503A, explicitly states that a student shall not establish domicile with residence primarily for educational purposes. And I think that's the most important question any institution has to answer when they're looking at one of these things. They have to find out if the student has moved here for primarily educational purposes. Otherwise, schools would not be able to ever charge out-of-state out-of-state tuition for students for all 4 years. All you have to do is come to this Virginia, live in Virginia for a year, get a part-time job, register to vote, get a driver's license, and then you'd be able to almost guarantee yourself in-state tuition after your freshman or sophomore year. And this is why the legislature made it explicitly clear in the statute. If you have come here for that purpose, you cannot establish a Virginia domicile. So beyond her own admission, there is other facts that was in the record that suggested that she also moved to Virginia for educational purposes. As soon as she moved here, she enrolled over in Northern Virginia Community College. She shortly afterwards got a part-time job. Right before she went to her school, she got her driver's license. All of these things auxiliary to her educational purposes. So when the university was looking at this the evidence or the record that she provided, Ms. Malik did not suggest anywhere that her educational purposes have been abandoned. And I believe that based on the statute and the guidelines and also this court precedent in Floyd, the university clearly had a reasonable basis to decide that based on the record, Ms. Malik did not carry her clear and convincing evidentiary burden standard. Beyond Ms. Malik's admission in her record, the university had given her also three levels of appeal as provided in the statute. She was providing information. She had three different chances to build a record to challenge that presumption or disprove it. As you may see from the court's transcript below, the lower court seemed to think that the burden was on the university to disprove Ms. Malik's domicile. That simply isn't the law. The statute is very clear that it's the student's burden, and a very high burden to carry on top of that. In addition, the lower court also seemed to make its own finding about Ms. Malik's domicile when she was born. Again, that's not a factor within the statute that the institution is supposed to look at. Where somebody's born over 20 years ago has very little probative evidence of somebody's present intent to stay somewhere indefinitely.
Particularly on the facts of this case.
Correct, Your Honor.
Your father's Pakistan.
Correct, Your Honor. And that's the other problem we had, is that it is really the student's burden to build this record and demonstrate that she abandoned, not only established a domicile in Virginia, but abandoned a previous domicile. And there's no evidence of a previous domicile, but she admits in the record that she first moved to Virginia in, September of 2013. And she has not listed any previous residence beyond that. So we really don't have any background information about where she came from. We have no way to even test the second part of the domicile exam. Did she abandon her previous domicile? So the record is very incomplete, and based on the fact that it's not the university's burden to disprove domicile, it's a student's burden, we believe that the lower court made a mistake by finding the university was arbitrary, capricious, otherwise contrary to law. And if Your Honor don't have any other questions, I'd be happy to take them now or save some time for rebuttal.
All right, you have 6 minutes left.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Jason Zellman, and I represent the appellee, Ms. Malik. There's 3 points I want to raise with the Court this morning. First, I want to discuss Ms. Malik's domicile. Second, I want to discuss the classification decision made by Northern Virginia Community College. And then third, I want to compare the factual circumstances of this case to the Court's prior precedent on classification issues for in-state and out-of-state students. First, with respect to Ms. Malik's domicile. It's our position that Ms. Malik is domiciled in Virginia. As opposed to the other cases where individuals were domiciled in other areas And then within a one-year time frame, we're doing things like registering to vote, registering
their cards. The issue of the kids is not technically that. Whether you can persuade any of us that she is truly domiciled in Virginia is not the issue of the kids. A decision maker has made a decision that your client had a very high standard of proof, very convincing, and for various reasons didn't get there. The question for us is not whether we agree or disagree with the decision, but whether we're prepared to say, that's so, I cannot conceive of a reason why anybody could possibly come to that arbitrary capricious decision.
I agree with that, Your Honor. I agree that you can't reweigh the evidence. You can't decide whether it was a good or bad decision that George Mason made. All you can do is look at the record that's before the court and that was before George Mason and decide if there was no basis or if George Mason's decision was arbitrary and capricious. I agree that that's the standard. I would also submit to the court that under the...
So my point is saying to us, she is domiciled in Virginia. It's not even a logical statement because maybe she is, in theory, and maybe we would all rule for you, in theory. But someone else ruled against you. That's the question.
Understood. And what my position, and I'm sorry if I wasn't clear, Justice Kelsey, was that based on the record before George Mason, it was arbitrary and capricious for them to find that at the time that she applied to their university that she was not domiciled in Virginia. And I apologize if I wasn't clear about that. Which leads into my second point, which is the classification decision that was made by Northern Virginia Community College and the State Council of Higher Education Guidelines, which you would find in the appendix starting at page 192, which state that an institution doesn't have to, it's not binding on George Mason, the decision made by Northern Virginia Community College, but it's something that they have to consider in making their decision. And when I look at the joint appendix, when I look at the brief from George Mason, the only thing they refer to is page 108 of the appendix, which is a letter denying Ms. Malik's appeal, which says, it appears from the record that you may have had been declared in-state at Northern Virginia Community College, but we don't know if you were or not. They acknowledge that that decision was made, but they don't specifically state anywhere in the record that they considered that decision, that classification decision made by Northern Virginia Community College.
Let me ask you this. You mentioned these guidelines.
Yes.
Does that have any kind of force of law?
I don't think the guidelines do have any enforceability of law. I think they're guidelines that the universities are to use in making their decisions.
So it's a helpful tool, right? I mean,
absolutely.
you're a university person. You say, where do I even begin? Oh, well, here's this helpful. But in other words, it's not necessarily an error of law for them to say, well, we don't really care what Northern Virginia Community College thinks. In other words, you don't have a statute that says you better consider that, or a regulation that says, hey, if you don't do this, that's arbitrary and capricious. Just a guideline. No, and so.
Absolutely, Justice McCall. I agree with that. My position would be that that's evidence of an arbitrary and capricious decision, and I think further evidence and an issue for this court that you may want to consider is we have two different institutions coming to contrary decisions, and part of what those guidelines specifically say is students who go into the community college, a two-year system, and want to transfer into a four-year system, there's supposed to be consistency involved in that process. And when we have a guideline system or a regulation system that's allowing different institutions to come to different conclusions, there's no predictability for the student at that time. And I would also submit that...
But discretionary policy concerns are not laws until they become laws. And it doesn't become arbitrary and capricious unless it's a law, a violation of law. It's so arbitrary, so capricious that the law cannot tolerate it.
Justice Kelsey, I agree with that. I think if I'm understanding what you're saying correctly, I think it would lead to a conclusion that a university's decision could never be arbitrary.
What I'm suggesting in that question, last question is, it's not arbitrary and capricious by statute or by regulation, as Justice McCullough points out. If one institution says, you know what, I don't agree with the guidelines. I just think that whatever the underlying policies are, we do things differently here. And that's an internal matter for the institutions to work out among themselves. It's not a matter for the judiciary to get involved in.
Particularly since the State Council of Higher Education is only an advisory body anyway, not a governing body, right?
Yep, absolutely. I agree with that. And I agree that they are guidelines. They do not have the enforceability of law. They are guidelines that can be followed.
The other thing is that if you are suggesting that one institution should be bound by another institution's decision on this point, I mean, the time of that decision could be very different. So it makes sense that each institution makes its own decision based on the time the student enters that institution.
Well, I agree with that.
I mean, years could go go by between community college and undergrad the last 2 years?
And they did. And in this case, what the record shows and what the record was that was before George Mason was that, well, first of all, when Ms. Malik applied to Northern Virginia Community College, obviously she'd been in the Commonwealth a much shorter time than she had been when she was at George Mason University, and they classified her as in-state. Prior to transitioning over to George Mason University, she took some time off from school, and the record shows she remained in the Commonwealth of Virginia during that time. And what George Mason's position is that on an application question, which it asked, what was your intent when you initially moved into the Commonwealth of Virginia? So that was in 2013. It did not ask what was her intent at the time she was applying for in-state tuition and for admission to George Mason University. What's your intent? She answered the question, what her initial intent was in 2013, which was, I'm coming here to get a better education and a better future. And to be honest with the court, you know, most college students who are asked a question by a university, you know, why are you coming to my university?
How has her intent changed?
Well, I think, Justice Mintz, the way her intent changed and the evidence of that is she came to Virginia for that education and because she had family here. She's been living with her brother the entire time. And I think the evidence of the change of her intent is that during that time period of, in 2015 where she was not at an institution, she remained in the Commonwealth of Virginia. She kept living here. She had a job here. She has started a business in the Commonwealth of Virginia. She's done all the other what George Mason would consider auxiliary activities, but what we say are evidence of what her domiciliary intent was because she has stayed in Virginia continuously since 2013 and wasn't at an educational institution that entire time.
Does your estoppel principle work both ways? Suppose a community college had said, look, we've looked at everything and the presumption's against you, you haven't met your clear and convincing, and we're not going to give you in-state status. And then she transfers, would that preclude her from saying, well, 3 months ago they said this, but things have changed. I've been thinking about this through, and I really want to be at Virginia.
Absolutely not. Absolutely.
So it binds it binds the institution, but it doesn't bind. It just cuts one way.
Well, that's not exactly what I'm saying, Justice Kelsey. What I'm saying is in this particular case, I'm not making a broad brush request as far as how it should be interpreted, but based on the facts of this case, the facts that were before George Mason in this case, nothing changed in the fact that she remained in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Her domiciliary intent didn't change during that time frame. If when she had applied
to me exactly the same scenario, if we just flip it upside down, the community college denies in state. And absolutely no fact is different when the second college, the transfer college, looks at it. As I understand what you're saying, it's arbitrary and capricious for that second college not to follow the first college.
I'm not trying to say that it would be arbitrary and capricious in every case. I'm saying it's arbitrary and capricious based on the record in this particular case.
Because nothing changed, and my hypothetical is assume in my hypothetical nothing changes.
If nothing had changed when she had applied for Northern Virginia Community College and between now and then, and they had made a determination that she was out of state and nothing changed in the interim, then absolutely.
Do we know on what basis Northern Virginia Community College did grant her, or do we just know their decision?
We just know their decision. Their considerations were not part of the record that was before George Mason, Your Honor. I would like to address some of the other cases the court has decided previously. George Mason does rely heavily on the Floyd case, which involved someone who is domiciled in Indiana prior to coming here, and they said that they were coming here to go to law school, and George Mason has analogized the facts of that case to Ms. Malik's case. What we think is the difference here is, again, in Floyd, that move to Virginia was within that one-year time frame. And in the other cases, I would submit to the court respectfully, the decision to change domiciliary intent and the move to come for education occur at the same time. Whereas here, Ms. Malik started doing things prior to starting her education. And in the interim, she did more steps to show her domiciliary intent to stay here. As I said, one of the big differences is she opened her own business, and her brother has a business that she worked at. She remained in the Commonwealth of Virginia after her time at Northern Virginia Community College was done and prior to going to George Mason University. And based on the record that was before George Mason University, there is nothing to show what her domicile was, if it was different prior to she applying to Northern Virginia Community College.
But there's no dispute she moved to Virginia, right, from somewhere.
Yes, that's correct. Okay. Yeah, that's correct. But what she does say...
Because it disprove her prior domiciliary status and prove that she abandoned a prior status to acquire a new status, a new domiciliary status.
I think her intent is clear from her behavior and from what she has done since she came to Virginia and why she came to Virginia.
What domiciliary status did she abandon when she came to Virginia? Where was she domiciled? And when was it abandoned prior to wanting to be domiciled in a new place, the Commonwealth of Virginia?
Well, I don't know that it's before the court where she was domiciled prior to being domiciled in Virginia, because that was not part of the record that George Mason had, and it's not part of the administrative record, not part of the joint appendix.
So then why isn't that dispositive? If I were a decision maker, I'd almost say game over there.
Well, I don't think it is dispositive at that point, because I think you can determine what her domiciliary intent is when she comes to Virginia. If you can tell from the record that her intent is, I'm now a domiciliary of Virginia, I'm abandoning my domicile, what it was before. It doesn't matter where it was.
It doesn't? It doesn't matter to the judge whether or not she's really abandoning it? Do you know if she's abandoning
it? I think it absolutely matters to judge whether she's abandoning it or not. Yes, absolutely. But I don't think where it was previously, having that knowledge, whether it was Indiana or Pakistan or Ohio or South Africa, I don't think that particularly matters. I think what George Mason has to consider is whether she had abandoned her prior domicile and whether her domiciliary intent was to be a Virginia resident. So George Mason, again, I'm sorry, I go back to the Floyd case, which is what I was trying to differentiate. George Mason tries to analogize it, but Ms. Malik had been in the Commonwealth for almost 4 years prior to applying to George Mason University, and in the Floyd case, again, that was 1 year. They also cite to the Ravindranathan case, which is a case where a medical student came here because her boyfriend had moved to the Commonwealth of Virginia, and the court found that that wasn't a domiciliary intent. But again, Ms. Malik came here because her family was here, her brother's here. Yes, she wanted to pursue her education, but she has remained in the Commonwealth of Virginia. She has made her domiciliary intent clear to remain here in the Commonwealth, not for an educational purpose, because the evidence is that she also, even in answering that question, said, I want to be here for a better future, to build my career, to get a good job. She's saying, that's why I came to Virginia. I intend to stay here and get a good job and build my career here in Virginia.
She didn't, that's not what she said. She didn't say here in Virginia. You're adding to her statement.
I am. I'm sorry. She said, I want to come and build a career and a good job, but then she stays in Virginia when she's not in school, opens a business here in Virginia. That's showing that her intent at the time that was her domiciliary intent was to be here in Virginia. That's evidence of it, that I want my business to be here after I get my education. I'm already starting one, and I want my job to be here in Virginia. That I think from the record there is no other conclusion the court can come to other than that she is a domiciliary and resident of the Commonwealth of Virginia. That's why Northern Virginia Community College came to that decision, and it was arbitrary and capricious for George Mason to come to a different decision, because there is nothing in the record that can allow them to conclude that she is not a domiciliary and resident of Virginia. Thank you, Your Honors. If there are no more questions, that's my answer.
Rebuttal?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just continuing over the question that you were speaking, that Mr. Zellner was just speaking to, in her brief, Ms. Malik argues that she had come in and out of Virginia sporadically, I believe. But the domicile question forms asked her to list all of her previous Virginia institutions. Previous Virginia addresses. And if there has been a break in those times from living in Virginia, please give reasons why. I believe that's on the appendix page 45, where it specifically asks, please provide documentation of your physical presence. When did you move to Virginia? She says 2013. And list all previous Virginia residences in which you resided, beginning with your current address. She only goes back to list to September of 2013, the same date that she says right here. And specify periods during which time you've resided outside of Virginia since you've initially moved to Virginia. There's nothing there. If residence in Virginia has been continued, has not been continued, give reasons or absences why. There's nothing there. So it's her burden to build this record and demonstrate that. And the second part of the test of, you know, I believe in the statute requires not only that she approves to, or establishes to a clear and convincing evidence that she's in Virginia domicile for the record, for the requisite 1 year period, but that she abandoned any previous domicile. And there's no evidence in there, but there's some indication, obviously, that that there is some previous domicile. And because that's not in the record anywhere, the university's decision not to find that she carried her burden cannot be considered arbitrary, capricious, or otherwise contrary to law. Because there's nothing in the record to show that, even though she is saying that at one point in time she had a previous domicile. The other issue, Your Honor, that, Mr. Zeldin was talking about with respect to her previous decision at NVCC. So again, that is not a dispositive answer. All the domicile guidelines say is you should consider it if the facts are in change. We have no idea if the facts have changed. All we have is a computer printout sheet of an itemized computer screenshot that shows at one point in time in-state tuition was charged to her at NVC. We don't have the decision letter. We don't have the application materials. We have no idea what she answered or what she said to the question is, why did you move to Virginia? We don't have any of that information in front of us, so we really can't rely on that as being a, even close to being dispositive. And in fact,
and different institutions could exercise their discretion differently, and one be more permissive than the other.
Correct, Your Honor.
Without the other or the former being arbitrary.
I think the guidelines in the statute actually mandate that. You're supposed to look at the totality of the circumstances, and that is going to inevitably lead to not taking somebody else's decision that was made a year or two ago as, you know, dispositive on the issue. And simply saying because NVCC granted her in-state tuition but GMU didn't as being the reason why GMU was arbitrary and capricious or otherwise contrary to law simply isn't true. It isn't what the statutes say. It's not. It wasn't even a decision that was made at the same time, and we have no idea what was in the record when she submitted that application to NVCC. Beyond that, Your Honor, if there's any other questions, I thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Call the next case.